CSI on the World. I'm John Batchelor. Behind the Black, Bob Zimmerman is here. We're going from the surface of the planet Earth to the, well, nearly the surface of the planet Mars now and again. Ingenuity, the flying toaster, setting new records all the time. Speed records, altitude records, repetition. Ingenuity is a great success, and it's the right aircraft of the future of exploring Mars with a helicopter. Bob, a very good evening to you. I like the fact that your report says helicopter healthy. How so? Good evening to you.
Good evening, John. Yes, over the weekend there were reports from the engineering team that runs Ingenuity that they were having problems. They had lost contact, and they were struggling to get contact back with the helicopter. They had done the last two flights, the 71st and the 72nd, had issues. The 71st flight had landed very prematurely, almost like one quarter of the distance it was supposed to travel, and therefore it landed in a place it wasn't supposed to land in. They apparently did have some communications with it, but it's very important that it land at a spot where it has line of sight contact with Perseverance, because Perseverance is the relay satellite, essentially. Communications are relayed through Perseverance. If it doesn't have line of sight, there's no communications. In fact, we had that situation in May and June of last year. There were no communications because the rover and the helicopter were far apart, and there was no line of sight communications. Once the rover moved into position, they got communications again. So it had landed in a spot where I think communications were difficult. They knew it was okay, and they could get commands to it. And what they did is, for the 72nd flight, is they wanted to go straight up 40 feet, establish good communications for a very short time to get some information and to localize the helicopter precisely. And then it was going to come back down and land in the same spot. Well, as it was going descending to the ground, they lost contact again, which I suspect it had to do with, once again, line of sight communications. They were just some things in the way that made it difficult to communicate. So that's the status. Now, a lot of the reporting of this has talked about how it was in trouble. I don't think it was ever really in serious trouble. It's not good to not be in communication, but I thought always from the start this just simply had to do with that line of sight communication with the rover. And they've now issued additional updates saying they have now reestablished communication with the helicopter. They don't have all the information yet out from it, but it's healthy. It landed vertical. It's not... it has power positive, which means its batteries are charged properly. It's sitting vertical on the surface, which means it didn't crash. They're running further diagnostic checks, tests, and they're going to be commanding Ingenuity to take some photos of where it is and then do what they call a spin test, literally turn the propellers on and run them around to make sure they work properly. All in all, it just appears to me that this is just communications issues with the helicopter. The problem, of course, is that if they don't have great communications, they can't give us, for example, I posted a map on Behind the Black. We don't have any updates of its location since its 70th flight, because they really don't know exactly where it flew and what. They haven't gotten on the last two flights, they have no pictures back yet. They can't download them. And so this is going to take a little time for them to fix, and it's probably going to have to wait until Perseverance moves into a better position. And they won't do that until they're ready, because they have their own work to do. But that they know the helicopter's healthy means that things are good, and we just have to wait.
Bob, my memory is that it's exceeded its back-of-the-envelope expectation by months and months, or maybe years.
Years.
Yeah, it was supposed to be a 30-day experiment, right, when they first landed?
Correct. They were supposed to do about a half a dozen flights in 30 days, proved you could fly on Mars, and that would be it. But, you know, if the engineering is working, then the more times you fly it, the more you learn about how you fly on Mars. Because if this works, this is a technology they're going to use a lot in the future. For example, I've already reported how some scientists are already doing preliminary design work on possibly sending a helicopter to the giant canyon, Valles Marineris. Paris, where you couldn't really send a rover very easily. The terrain's too rough. But you could do a helicopter there, hop along. And so they're looking at this in the future. So the more times Ingenuity flies and the more times they learn about how to operate it, how to fly it within that atmosphere, the more they can help design future helicopters properly, John.
And helicopters wouldn't make any sense on the moon, right? That there's no
There's no atmosphere. Yeah, so. You know, it'd go around and around and around, Capella, but there's nothing, no lift because there's no air.
All right, so we're going to the surface of the moon, and this is a success and not success. It's called SLIM. What is that, Bob?
SLIM is a Japanese lunar lander, unmanned lander, that was sent to the moon to test precision autonomous landing by a robot. Get your landing within a very tight landing zone. And that's to, if robots can do that, they can send landers or probes to a lot more difficult places. The landing zones generally be much larger, which means you take greater risks if you don't have a good system to be precise then. So SLIM did successfully land last week. They had an issue with the batteries. The batteries were not getting charged by the solar panel. This is an engineering experiment. Its main goal was to land, and it did that successfully, softly. We've had a lot of failures in trying to land, so this was a big success. The solar panel on it was an engineering test in its own right. It was testing a flexible solar panel design that you can unroll and you know, also store easily and also use as a blanket, maybe insulation blanket over the body of the spacecraft. The way the spacecraft landed on the moon, it appears that the panel was facing west. But the lander landed in the morning on the moon, which meant the sun is in the east. So it wasn't getting any light. And because it wasn't getting any light, the batteries weren't getting charged, and they were running out of power. And they figured they'd run out of power within 3 hours. Well, they made a decision to shut SLIM down, put it into safe mode when its battery still had a charge of 12%. And the reason was they didn't want the batteries to run down to zero because it would be difficult, if not impossible, to get them restarted again. You wouldn't be able to charge them very easily when they run to zero. But at 12%, everything's on safe mode. It's not using battery power. When the sun gets over to the west and starts to set, they're hoping that the solar panels start to pick up some sunlight, will begin to charge the batteries, and then the spacecraft will come back to life, and they can get some data while it's still on the moon. That's their hope, and so we stand by for another week or so.
And the moving of the sun to where the panels are, this will be a regular occasion. It can charge them when the sun's in the right place, and it'll.
Yeah. I mean, the sun rises in the east and sets in the west on the moon, just like on Earth. But it takes 14 days on the moon to do this. Its day is 28 days long from night to morning. So they had 2 weeks of sunlight when they landed, but they wanted to land in the morning to get the full lunar day. The trouble is that the panel is on the west side, right. So it needs to have the sun to come around to the west, hit it, and once some sunlight hits that panel, they're hoping the power will start to charge the batteries, and they can open up, they can turn the system on again. I must emphasize that the main goal of this mission was to land, to prove it could land and do it in this very precise manner. And they haven't gotten all their telemetry back, and they haven't yet back yet, and they haven't yet released their conclusions, but they say they are very optimistic that this achieved its goal precisely. And I should point out, it actually did soft land and operated, which is something that multiple other landers have recently have tried to do and have not succeeded.
So
this is an achievement for
them. I will describe this as a success and a success. There's no failure here whatsoever.
No, absolutely right, John. It's an engineering test, and it really was a success. You know, if they don't get any scientific data they would get on the lunar surface was going to be it'll be okay. Might have been able to get some scientific data, but mainly this is an engineering test to test landing on the moon.
Bennu is an asteroid, and we have a sample return, but we couldn't get the darn thing open. How are they doing, Bob?
They got it open. I have a picture on behind the black of the open sample return capsule that was sent to Earth from a Ceres Rex after it rendezvoused with Bennu and did a grab-and-go touchdown where it grabbed some samples and then moved away. It got a lot of samples. It got so many samples, in fact, that before they could open the sample return capsule, there was about 70 grams clinging to the outside. And their goal had always been to get about 70 grams. So before they even opened the capsule, they had met their goal. But they then wanted to open the capsule to see what they had actually captured. They figured they had a lot inside. They couldn't get it open. It had basically screws that held it in place, and the talks were such that the equipment they had to unscrew them was not doing the job. And so rather than, they wanted to be very careful how they opened this so they didn't contaminate it with Earth environment. So it's inside a glove box, which means you can only get to it through rubber gloves. And so they needed to design and build a machine, a special tool that would be able to open those final two fasteners that were too tight. And they got those to work. They've opened it. I've got a picture on behind the black. You can see the material inside. They still don't know exactly how much mass they obtained. They're now in the process of removing this material, putting it into trays and weighing it. And we'll have in a few weeks, we'll have an idea of how much material inside the capsule they obtained. They got a lot, though. They got
it looks like charcoal, but Bob, those little bitty pebbles, right? Is that is that from the early solar system? Is that it?
Yes. Yes. No question. It looks like charcoal because it's as dark as soot. It's very dark. This kind of asteroid that Bennu is a dark asteroid. It literally is like soot, like ash, like charcoal. And that's what these rocks are. And they are definitely material from the primeval early solar system. Very delicate type material that when this kind of asteroid hits the Earth and reaches the surface, most of this material generally burns up because it's so delicate. Right. So they do not have a real sense of the kind of materials that are in the asteroids and the solar system. And the only way we could get that is to actually get samples from the asteroids without damage. And so they had to do a sample return.
So these pebbles are the planetary disk. That's what we're looking at.
Yeah, essentially, yes, that's correct. We're going to find out a great deal about the early solar system from this material.
It's a really cool picture. I urge everybody to look at it. You're looking back 4 billion years and before.
Yeah.
Otherwise, I would say, good heavens, there's a lot of dust around here. Now we go to Percy. Looking back, I'll remind everybody what Percy's up to, Bob.
Before we do that, John, I want to mention something about that asteroid material. You realize that we're actually looking at dust that was formed in supernovas of stars. So this is star. This is we're all made of stars here, John. That's what this material is. So going to Perseverance. Perseverance is the second operating rover on Mars. Curiosity is the other. Perseverance is the one that works with Ingenuity. But Perseverance had a really cool picture recently by their high resolution camera, and so I posted it on Behind the Black with a map to where I think it's looking. I'm pretty sure it's looking back the way it came across G0 crater. At the floor of the crater, we really don't see the rim because it's blocked by intermediate hills that are in the floor of the crater. But it's just, Perseverance has begun to climb up a little bit. So we're beginning to get some views. And I'm a tourist in these matters, so I'm interested in the views. And this is just a good example.
There's some big rocks here, Bob. What are those? An asteroid breakup?
No, we're looking at the material at the floor of, Perseverance is on the delta that flowed into G0 crater from a gap in the rim. And that material was flowed in by some kind of liquid or mud or ice. And so what we're looking at here is, on Earth, we might say immediately, it's glacial cobble. It's the material that glaciers pushed in ahead of them. In this case, it could be material that was brought in by flowing water, or it could be brought in by ice, or it could be a combination of the two, or it could be water-impregnated mud that, you know, flowed like water almost. But that's where the rocks are. They're suspended in that material. And so we're looking at the remains of that, essentially.
It looks like what happens after a glacier retreats, what's left of
it. Yes. That's exactly right. It does, doesn't it? And once again, the theories have generally, being Earth, Earthlings, we look at the channels on Mars and this delta in Jezero Crater, and we immediately think flowing water. But the evidence is accumulating to suggest that maybe it wasn't flowing water, but flowing glaciers that caused a lot of these things, or a combination of flowing water and flowing glaciers. But yes, this looks like the kind of a cobble that you see in moraines on Earth at the head of a glacier after it's retreated.
Now, there are more elegant ways to say this. A splat on Mars. What am I looking at?
There might be more elegant ways, but it's a lot more fun to call it that. It's a splat. That's exactly right. This is a picture I came across from Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter. I love these cool images. And basically what we're looking at, it looks like a flow going from the west to the east, except it's in the dry equatorial region. So this is not related to any kind of water that exists for at least a billion years.
Okay.
It appears to have been a splat caused by an oblique impact that created a crater, and the splat was flow that moved away to the east, away from the oblique impact. Whether was it lava? Was it water? Was a combination of both? If it did, it means there was if there was water here when this happened, it just indicates that the dry equatorial regions of Mars once had water or ice, and there might be evidence of this might tell us evidence of maybe underground ice, deep underground.
Bob Zimmerman, Behind the Black, we're going engineering. I'm John Mack.
Stay tuned for more of CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.